And I looked at how long we might on average live for in the UK. And I looked at, you know, that figure. And it came up with 233,000 apologies in the average Brit's lifetime.
The first question I asked them was, what do we want our children to look like as human beings when they leave our school community? And it was a really interesting conversation because there was a very clear awareness of the strengths and weaknesses of that community. And what it led to was a very powerful conversation. What it also did, Andy, was it meant for the first time in a decade, we weren't just trying to implement systems and structures. We started from a human point of connection.
Welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast, hosted by Andy Lapata, the show where Andy and his guests explore the many ways in which relationships impact business decisions, make leaders' jobs easier, and help you to progress your career.
Hello and welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast. I'm Andy Lapata. Thank you very much for joining me. Just as the schools in the UK for sure break up for the summer, we're going back to school today. So it's back to school very, very early. But my guest today's history, shall we say, is rooted in education, though he certainly hasn't stayed exclusive to that. He's well known for turning around a failing school in under 2 years, becoming known as the Walt Disney of the classroom. He's won a UNESCO Award for Leadership and Innovation. He's a Global Guru's Top 30 Thinker and was Head Teacher of the Year in the National Teacher Awards. He's now known as one of the world's most influential experts on change and human leadership, and he's the author of 4 books drawing on his experience as an educator and a consultant to business, and he's the host of the Learning Bridge podcast, so he should know all about what we're doing here today. So let's find out. Richard Gerver, thank you very much for joining me.
It's an absolute pleasure, Andy. Thanks for having me on, and thanks also for reading out my mum's email that she clearly sent you.
Yeah, don't worry. People do it for me as well. So I want to pick up on something I did mention there, where you said you turned around a failing school in under 2 years. So tell us how you did it, and in particular, what challenges came up. And, you know, if a school is failing, you've got deep issues that are embedded. And you almost need to move people through the school and out of the school who carry those habits and that culture with them before you can refresh a culture. So how did you do that in such a short period of time and effectively change those habits in people who are still in the school?
Great. The first thing to say, Andy, is I became the head teacher of that school almost by accident. It's very important because you'll see the context for that, right? So at the time, I'd been seconded to work with the government on developing some programs to remotivate demotivated children, particularly in areas of reading and writing. Anyway, to cut a very long story short, one of the schools they wanted me to get involved in the project was the school I became the principal of. I wasn't expecting to, but I fell in love with the place the first time I walked in there. It was one of those weird, you know, like people maybe will relate to this. You know, when you go house hunting, right? And you can see maybe 8 or 10 houses that on the details look exactly the same. The layout looks the same. They're all in your price bracket, et cetera, et cetera. And you walk into one and for no apparent reason, you just know it's going to be home or you want it to be home, right? That happened to me on that first day. And I think that's really important because the context of the school had been, it had been habitually failing for nearly a decade. It had been declining for a decade. It had nearly 8 school principals in 12 years, right? So the previous one had been off on long-term sick and was being taken through ill health capability procedures so that he could be stood down. So I knew there was a vacancy. I also knew, this is important, that the ultra experienced deputy principal, deputy head teacher, who had been in the school for over 30 years of her own career and had been acting head teacher on all of those, you know, previous moments, had no intention and no desire to be the head. So anyway, I applied for the job because it wasn't in my orbit at the time, but I applied for it because I'd fallen in love and got it. Now, in the first instance, I thought, my ego went into overdrive, right? I thought, oh my God, I'm a school principal. Everybody must look at me differently now with some kind of exuding respect because, you know, I'm a pillar of the community. although my wife has often used other words to describe that. But anyway, I got the job. And what I realized very quickly, the ego went into meltdown when I found out I signed my contract with the director of education, who said, "Thank God you applied." And I was like, "Oh, really? That's great." He said, "No, you were the only applicant."
Back down to earth.
So I went from hero, in a matter of moments. But the reason I realized very quickly once I'd started the job, the reason I realized I'd fallen in love with the place were the people. You know, I hadn't fallen in love with the building. I wasn't one of these people that wanted to be a heroic leader. I had just walked into a place where I had fallen in love with the vibe, the atmosphere, the people, the children in particular, obviously, but also the staff. And I think very early on, what I detected was a group of people who actually really, really cared about their community. So again, to put it into context, the staff in the school had been relatively static for a long time, right? So the deputy over 30 years, the assistant head over 30 years, there were members of staff there who'd had their own children go through the school, a couple that had been there as students themselves. One had his granddaughter starting in the lower years of the school. This was a group of people absolutely at the heart of their community. Now, on the one hand, you could say that's a real problem. On the other hand, you could say these people really understood and cared deeply about the environment they were in. Now, to cut a very long story short, what had been clear to me was these people weren't bad. They weren't wanting to give up. They weren't wanting to just shirk responsibility and do the minimum. They were angry, and they were angry because they'd felt disenfranchised, right? Over that decade, they'd had experts come in and tell them what to do, whether those were government advisors, local authority people, hired experts, you know, "You're rubbish, do this. You're rubbish, do this. You're rubbish, do this." And for me, what was missing at the heart of the school was the emotional heartbeat, the vision, the real value, the sense of purpose in that community. These were people from their community. They cared about it. They understood it. They got it. And what had happened over that period of time was layers of concrete had been poured on that passion, their values, and they'd been projected on from other people. Now, I came from a very different background to many. I'm a Northwest London middle-class boy. I was private school educated, although I spent all of my career in education working in the state sector. I knew what they didn't need was this middle-class bloke walking into their school going, "This is what you need to value. This is how it needs to happen." And so at the very heart of the transformation for me was re-enfranchising these people and believing that if we could do that, we could reignite their flame and their energy, and they would take ownership of what needed to happen. So I remember very early on, the first question I asked the staff in this community was, what do we want our children to look like when they leave us? What we needed to do was get to the point in our community where we could help our staff and our community rediscover their sense of purpose, their sense of values. And it was really important to me. So what I discovered really quickly were the people in this school community were passionate about their community. They were rooted in their community. And I think what had happened was over years, they'd had layers of concrete poured on top of that passion, that professionalism, that sense of self-worth that had left them disenfranchised and disempowered. So what was really important to me was reconnect immediately. And the first question I asked them was, what do we want our children to look like as human beings when they leave our school community? And it was a really interesting conversation because there was a very clear awareness of the strengths and weaknesses of that community. And what it led to was a very powerful conversation. What it also did, Andy, was it meant for the first time in a decade, we weren't just trying to implement systems and structures. We started from a human point of connection. And that gave us a sense that we could own those systems and structures and make sure they worked for us in our community in the right way. And when I look back on it now, although that sounds like kind of, to some people, soft underpinnings, it was the accelerant that allowed us then to build really quickly for our children. You know, one point that I really want to make at this point, and I know most of our audience don't come from that sector, we need to remember children only get one go, right? So for a teacher or a head teacher, it may be 1 year out of many in a career. For that child, that year can be deeply formative. Mm. So we couldn't muck around and we had to move fast.
Well, that's a really important point, isn't it? Because that has come up time and time again since COVID. The damage the lockdowns did and the lack of the ability to socialize for children over those 3 years could harm them for a long period of time.
I think it's a really interesting point, and I'm seeing it now play out, as I'm sure you are and many of your listeners are, at a recruitment level. I was recently doing some work for one of the Big Five, and we were doing a graduate training program, so for their global graduate entry. And I was asking the woman who was running the training for the new intake, what are your greatest challenges? She said, these young people, Richard, are phenomenal when it comes to doing stuff in front of a screen. They're absolutely extraordinary, right? Yeah, they can data map, they can do anything you need them to do. But she said, increasingly, our clients are wanting face-to-face. They want to feel the human connection, right? And she said, these young people are terrified of having human interaction on a professional level. And it really strikes me that we're not just going to see it, if you like, in those children who were school children as in the COVID generation, but those young people that were coming out of school, going into university, going into apprenticeships, higher education, who were deprived of some of the essence of that ability to interact on a human level with each other.
Yeah, I saw it recently. About a month ago, I was in one of my local schools. I go in every year. They have a day or a morning for year nines. Well, actually, they have a day. I go in for the morning, called What's My Line? And anyone who remembers the old game show, they bring in local business people and we sit there while the kids in groups of six or seven have 20 yes-no questions or 20 questions for which we can answer yes or no to ask us so that they can guess what we do for a living. And it was quite striking this year just how many wouldn't even make eye contact and would sit through the whole 6 minutes of their session with me, not engaging. So a group of seven or eight, you would normally have this year three that weren't engaging at all. And there was nothing you could do to draw them in. You know, you try and encourage them and so on. And I think I've always seen an element of that, but it struck me this year as worse than perhaps before COVID. So that's one way in which it plays out. In terms of what you shared, there's lots of things I want to pick up on. I just want to highlight, rather than raise as a question, your comment that it wasn't the systems and structures that you needed to start with, but starting from a human point of connection, because obviously that goes to the core of what this podcast is all about and is well worth highlighting. And it makes absolute sense. You know, it's the difference between the systems driving the human behavior and the human behavior being supported by systems. And we need to think much more in that human connected way, even when we're building systems around our organizations. But there's three key things I want to dig a little bit more deeply in. So let's start with your background, because going back to the beginning of your answer, you said you had been working on motivating demotivated pupils. Let's talk about that, because I'm sure there are many people who listen to this who have members of their teams who struggle for motivation, who they can't, throw themselves enthusiastically into a project, go the extra mile, whatever it might be. How do you motivate people who don't seem to want to be motivated?
That's a great question. And I think in the end, it parallels back to the response we were just discussing around how we motivated the adults in that community. You know, for a lot of young people, and I think it's true at any level, actually, but certainly it's where I first discovered it. For a lot of young people, the education journey is incredibly passive, right? So in other words, they are told to leave whatever their interests might be at the door, because I'm going to tell you what's important. Yeah. I'm going to tell you how you're going to do what I tell you is important. Then I'm going to measure you on my parameters. And then I'm going to reward you whether what you've done is delivered on what I think is important. And I think in terms of motivation, often it is linked to that point I talked about before, this sense of disenfranchisement, of victimhood, of being done to. The link is very potent and very powerful. There is an argument that says the traditional system of mass education educates us enough, but not too much. So in other words, it educates us to do what we're told, but it doesn't educate us to a point where we are actually encouraged to self-lead, think for ourselves, be dynamic, right? And it goes back to the problem with the Big Five. You know, give these high-powered, highly qualified graduates a job, and they'll do it really efficiently. Ask them to think for themselves or be developmental in that process. Very different idea. And I think at the heart of this is that, right, there is no doubt that leadership and management in an organization needs to lead and define the strategic direction. But one of the problems in most workplaces, I think, is that we run cultures of what I call assumed incompetence. In other words, we assume people will only do their best if they're made to, if they're managed to, if they're given performance management targets that incentivize them just to do what they're told to do. So we perpetuate that kind of culture. And what that leads to, of course, is an employee base often who go, well, just tell me what you need me to do. Just tell me how you want me to do it, and I'll do it for you to the best of my ability. What we're now finding, of course, in a post-industrial age is that focus on efficiency and simply productivity based on an efficiency model is completely outdated. We need to be far more fleet-footed. We need to be entrepreneurial. We need to be developmental. We need people who can really think on their feet around a problem that's unique to them that they're dealing with. You know, again, I'm sure like many of our listeners and you, one of the greatest complaints I hear from the corporate sector, from middle managers, is those people spend so much time solving the problems of the people who are in their teams, they don't actually get to do their jobs. And when they do get the time, it's outside of work hours. So they're working overtime just to accomplish what their pay description said. So for me, one of the really important things around motivation is to include people early. So it doesn't feel like a fait accompli. So you may be a manager, you may be a leader, and you may feel the pressure under your pay grade is, I've got to solve the problem. That's what I'm paid the extra money for. I don't believe that's true. I believe your job is to work out who in your team is best placed to help solve that problem, who have skills, knowledge sets that you don't, right? And we might come on to that later, because that's all about the harnessing and building of the human relationship and understanding one another. And actually what we need to do is, if you spark people's curiosity, if you get them generating questions early and they're interested in the problem, they feel engaged, feel that they're helping to solve the problem and find the solution, which means they feel a sense of ownership in what it is you're asking them to do. And therefore, they are far more committed to being involved in working through that, implementing it and developing it. So I think, you know, that's hugely important. And by the way, just again, going back to the parallel, one of the reasons why this stuff is so interesting to me and I'm so passionate about it is, apparently, and I don't know how you percentage it, but the concept is right, we learn somewhere between 70 and 75% of everything we learn in our lifetime before we're 5 years old, right? Now, I'm not talking about the knowledge that comes with experience, but if you think about the complexity of the first 5 years of our lives, most of us learn to walk and talk, understand vocal intonation, facial expression, body language. We learn to make sense of the sensory world around us. If we're born into a multilingual home, we pick up every language spoken in that domestic. We are learning machines. We are developmental machines. Why? Because at the heart of the way we think before we're five is curiosity. It's about active engagement. So to me, what we have to do is develop cultures in our organizations which are less about efficiency and an assumption of incompetence and more about active engagement, trust, and a kind of assumption of excellence.
Two things there. First of all, I have to acknowledge it, because regular listeners would be amazed if I didn't. You've talked about curiosity at the end there. That is a thread that runs throughout these conversations. It comes up time and time and time again. The quote that I share so often from an earlier episode of the Connected Leadership podcast, my guest was Daniela Landher, who was a global head of talent at Google. And she said, we have to move away from trying to be the smartest person in the room to the one who learns the most. And she talked about moving to, rather than having EQ, an IQ, we have LQ, a learning quotient, you know, trying to learn more. So curiosity is absolutely key. The other thing is, all the way through your last answer, I felt there was one word missing, and you brought it in at the very end. But I think that everything you talked about goes towards forming it, and that's trust. It's reliant on trust, and being able to work in the way that you've outlined relies on trusted relationships. But you've also expressed how you develop those trusted relationships by putting your faith in people, by involving them in the conversation, by making it about their agenda, not setting the agenda in stone for them. When you go into a school that's failing, when you come into a business that's struggling, where you come into any environment where the culture isn't right, at the heart of that, at the core of that, is a breakdown of trust. So when you go into that environment, how do you go from a culture of distrust to a culture of positive trust, where people will take on that delegation, will believe you when you say we're interested in what you think?
It's interesting, isn't it? And it seems to me to be deeply pertinent right now, because in at least two of our most potent democracies around the world, we're going through, as we're recording this, general elections, right, in the US and in the UK. And one of the big themes of both of those elections right now is based on mistrust. People don't trust any politician anymore to do anything for them. And I think that's for a number of reasons. And I think it parallels back into a workplace, right? If people don't feel listened to, if they don't feel understood, if they feel deeply disenfranchised, if they feel that the people in the top positions are doing what they're doing for their own benefit, in spite of, you know, the real concerns and feelings of the people working for them, it really creates a fissure, right? It creates a fracture between the two. And then on top of that, you kind of amplify that with a sense that people aren't listened to. You know, they're desperately screaming out, going, this is my life, this is my problem. What then happens is, you create an opportunity where populism takes root and people become angry and polarized, or they become siloed, right? And to me, I see that so often in the workplace, where that first fissure of trust, which comes from leaders, and again, we all see it all the time. A new manager, a new leader is appointed to an organization. They come in, the reflex of the people on the workforce is, what bloody ideas are they going to bring in that we're going to have to implement now? How long will that person be here before they drift off, take another job, or end up changing their minds because 6 months down the line, the agenda's changed for whatever reason? So that deep skepticism grows. And I think, again, what it comes down to at the heart of trust building, step one is listen, is really listen to what people have to say. I remember years ago, I love American politics and American history for my sins. And I remember years ago doing some research into Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. And in my naivety as a young person, I used to think this address would have been a soaring piece of oratory, you know, 20 minutes long, Kennedy-esque, Obama-esque, some kind of soaring oratory that went on and on and on. I can't remember the exact number, but when you look at the Gettysburg Address, I think it's less than 450 words. Yeah. And so then what really interested me is how, in less than 450 words, do you change the direction of an entire nation, right? And what was really interesting was I then found an article, a journalist had talked to Lincoln about how he'd prepared for the Gettysburg Address. And he said, for 2 weeks before I gave the address, what I did was I just went out into our communities, the people I needed to influence. And I listened to them. I listened to their problems. I listened to their concerns. And I made sure I responded to them in the address. And then what was really important, he said, then I acted on it. So for me, you start with listening, but really authentic listening. And then what you have to demonstrate is action in response to that listening. And if you do that, people start to sit up and take notice and say, maybe she or he really does care. Maybe I can open up a bit more. And then that leads to, I think, the biggest pillar within developing a culture of trust, and that's authenticity. I think it's really important as a leader that you show your vulnerability, that you admit sometimes when you're wrong or fearful or you've gone down a wrong direction, that you're not as good as somebody else at solving a problem or a particular technical issue, whatever else it might be, because then you can open up that authenticity. And again, if you open up that point of authenticity, then you can get to a point where really meaningful dialogue and interaction can take place.
Enhance your mentoring skills with the Financial Times Guide to Mentoring by Andy Lapata and Dr. Ruth Gotian. Secure your copy early by pre-ordering today on Amazon or your preferred bookseller.
All of these things you talk about are at the heart of what I speak about. You know, regular listeners will know that these are very much the topics that I focus on. And I think they all sit together almost in a virtuous cycle where if you're curious, you listen, you open up more authentically, you become more vulnerable, which makes you more curious and so forth. So you create a really nice virtuous cycle around that. I feel a blog and diagram coming on. So I think they all work really well together. So I won't dig further into that because I think that was just such the perfect answer for that. And I know regular listeners will know that I will always latch on talking about vulnerable leadership and vulnerability and so forth. I want to go back to your original answer because I said there were three things I wanted to pick up on. We've only talked about one of them. The second one is you talked about the impact on the teachers and the staff and the pupils probably as well at the school you were at of being told you're failing, you're failing, you're failing, you're rubbish, you're rubbish, you're rubbish. So I want to talk a little bit about negative and positive reinforcement in terms of the impact it has on people. How do you manage giving critical feedback in a way that doesn't demotivate? How do you use positive reinforcement in a way that isn't cheesy and cliched? How do you get that balance right where you can be blunt, you can be honest, you can tell people, actually, this isn't good enough, but in a way that lifts them rather than drops them further down?
Just before I do that, I just want to add to the point originally, and this is how bad it was. So people might not be able to see us right now, Andy, but I am follically challenged these days. But fortunately for me, when I became a school principal, I had hair. And one of the things I used to do, or I tell people to do now, and I did then before I actually took up my tenure, so nobody knew who I was, I visited a local barber's and I sat there and had my hair done. And the reason I did that was because when you say to people, so what's this place like, right? What's this? They're going to be honest with you because they don't know who you are and you're hearing from people in the community, right? And one of the things I heard which shocked me was some of the parents were so ashamed of their kids going to this school that in the morning and in the afternoon, they made them cover up their uniforms. So when they were walking down the street, other people in the community didn't know they went to that school community, right? Which is extraordinary for me. And so what that leads to is exactly your point. In a hyper form, people were so ashamed because they were told they were so rubbish that that had then radiated out into the parents, but not even the parents and carers, into the wider community. I remember very early on in my teacher training, when I was training to be a professional, one of the things that kept being told to us was never keep telling a child they're naughty. Because if you keep telling a child they're naughty, they will start to behave to expected behavioral patterns, right? So they will start to believe themselves they're the naughty kid. And I think that translates very, very powerfully. Because if you keep telling people they're failing, they're useless, they're not up to the job, they're rubbish, they go to bed at night thinking it doesn't matter what I do, I'm rubbish, I'm useless, I'm not up to the job. I feel trapped in the job, I don't want to be there, they don't want me to be there. Tomorrow I'll get a new task, I still won't do it properly. And I think the really important thing is, first of all, it links to what we've just talked about, authenticity, listening, building human relationships, at the heart of that, building trust, right? And it's also understanding if somebody isn't achieving what they need to achieve, why. So, for example, is there something going on in their personal life that might mean that they're underperforming? Is there something that's happened at work where their confidence has been knocked, where they've got conflict with somebody else in their team or silo or whatever else it might be? Is that the problem? Are they in the wrong job? They're the person with the right attitude, but actually, I remember years ago interviewing Richard Branson, and he said, you know, I was originally asked to do The Apprentice. And he said, I turned it down. And the reason I turned it down, he said, was I hated the strap line, you're fired, right? He said, because I've always believed, and he said, you do sometimes have to fire people. He said, but I've always believed that if you have to fire somebody, it's as much your fault as it is theirs, because you employed them and you put them in the job that wasn't right for them. Therefore, you have to be culpable, right? Which I think is all part of this. So for me, what's really important, and I don't believe it is cheesy, is to really climb inside that person, try and understand. And if you've got great relationships, it's much easier than if you're starting from scratch. You know, don't try and build a great relationship with somebody who's struggling at the point they're struggling. We've got to be preemptive. But get to a point where, again, you listen to them, you're listening to their context, you're listening to their experience, you're listening to why they're saying they're not achieving, they're failing, they're underperforming. And look at the variables you can help them to control. I think, you know, what you do, Andy, and it's not my area of expertise in terms of coaching, for example, is hugely important here, because it's not about creating or perpetuating a dependency culture. I'm the leader. I'll tell you what to do. I'll solve your problems for you. I'll give you the solutions. It's actually helping that person to feel enfranchised and empowered, to be able to overcome those challenges for themselves. Because there is going to be nothing more fantastic in that person's own sense of worth and value than if they feel they've overcome a challenge or a problem or a failure. You may have supported them to do it, but then that helps that person to grow. And their own sense of self-worth grows. Their relationship with you grows. And so I think what's really important at the heart of all of that, long-winded way round of saying it, is when you're giving people feedback, when you're having honest conversations, make sure at the heart of that conversation is a ladder that helps them climb out themselves.
I don't know if you can do this, and anything springs to mind, but it would be really interesting if you could talk, obviously without naming any name, if you could talk about how you handled the most disruptive pupils at that school, you know, maybe the worst bully. People that were not just not engaging with the learning, but were actually having a massive negative impact on the people around them. Are there any stories you can share where you can talk about how you address that and how you turn it around?
Off the top of my head, there are two. There's one about a pupil, and there's actually one about a member of staff, because I think both are linked. And I think it's really important that people realize one of the things that I've been passionate about through the last two decades of my career, since I kind of pretty much left frontline education, is that we've got to stop believing that problems are unique in the adult world and the children's world, and that somehow education environments are different to a normal workplace, because actually so much of it is generically linked. So the first one was when I was a very young teacher. I had a young boy in my class, and I was working in an area of, all of my career I worked in areas of social deprivation, but it was an area of social deprivation. And I remember being warned about this kid, right? You know, when you get your class list as a teacher for the next year, it's a bit like playing scratch card lottery. You look at your list and people in the staff room either go, oh, you'll love that kid, or they just go, oh dear, right? And I was going down my list and a couple of members of staff went, oh dear. Anyway, sure enough, very early on in the school year, this kid was, as predicted, he was, frankly, and I can use this language here, a pain in the ass. He was very, very difficult to deal with. He was disruptive. He wasn't engaging. He was often trying to suck other kids into of behavior. I think very early on, what I realized, of course, and I think it's true of all people, but certainly with children, and I've kind of alluded to it already, bad behavior is the outcome. It isn't the reason, right? There's always a reason for that bad behavior. And often with kids who bully, who try to disrupt, actually, ironically, at the heart of it is a profound sense of inadequacy. They actually feel deeply vulnerable. And so what they do is they attack first in order to try not to allow themselves to expose that vulnerability. And that was definitely the case with this kid. His self-worth was on the floor. He came in every day knowing he wasn't as clever as some of the other kids, knowing he didn't understand as well. And of course, that becomes a self-perpetuating thing, because the less you engage in learning, the further you fall behind, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, for me, I pulled him aside one day after a disruptive lesson. And the first question I asked him was, is there anything in your life you love? I mean, what, you know, all you do is tell me about you hate this, you're bored, you don't like that. Is there, what do you love? And it was an extraordinary moment because he said, what, for real? And I went, yeah. He said, I'll tell you. He said, don't laugh. I said, I won't. He said, I keep racing pigeons. He said, my grandfather got me into it. He said, I keep racing pigeons. He said, and every morning I get up at 5 a.m. to clear out the coop and look after the pigeons. And every evening I do this after school. And then at weekends I race the pigeons, I train them. And he went on and on and on, Andy. And his eyes lit up and his body language changed, right? And it was the most revelatory thing. And I thought about it overnight and I got permission, because in those days we didn't have quite the same health and safety checks we do now within schools. I got permission from the head teacher and I got permission from him and his granddad. And a few days later, we took the whole class down to his pigeon coop and we said, tell them about what you do. Tell them, introduce them to the racing pigeons. Talk to them about what you do. And he came alive. And his sense of self-worth was transformed. And his behavior in class similarly. Suddenly he came into class, his shoulders were held high because the other kids were really in awe of something he did. He felt better about that and he engaged in the learning journey. And to me, that was such a potent story. And it links, when I became the head teacher at Grange, there was an alpha member of staff. There's always an alpha member of staff, whether you're in a school or an organization. There's always one member of staff whose profound job it is to suck the enthusiasm out of everybody else to make themselves feel better, right? And we'll call this guy John, okay? And John was the alpha member of staff, and he was a miserable bugger. And he was just constant. And I was warned about him when I took the job. You know, this guy's going to be difficult. He's going to try and pull the staff and deliberately silo and all this kind of stuff. I remember, again, very early on, walking into the staff room from my office to make myself a cup of coffee. And it was a break time. And he sat there with his disciples in the staff room in his usual seat, drinking out of his mug. And I knew what he was doing the minute I walked in, because I thought, I'll go to the back of the room, make my coffee, go back to my office and just allow them the time to chat. But he wanted me to hear what he was going to say. And he did it for my benefit. And he said, of course, I never wanted to be a teacher. Right. And I thought, oh, God, I'm not going to react. I'm just going to listen in. Never wanted to be a teacher. He said, I blame my father. He said, my father ran a local retail business. He said, and I, as a kid growing up, worked in the retail. I had such dreams. I was going to take over the business. I blame my father because he was such a useless business person. By the time I got old enough, the business had gone bust. Right. And he said, so I thought, what else can I do? I trained as a teacher. Anyway, that was the benefit. It was like, you know, just wanting to lay his flag in the sand, I think. And I thought about it. And we were developing some really interesting stuff, which we won't go into today. But if people want to know more, they can find out more on the internet about me or in my books and stuff and the story. But one of the things that I thought about was I wanted to build in the school a retail business for the children to run themselves. This idea of context and purpose to learning speaks back to something earlier we were talking about. How did you motivate demotivated people? And I really wanted to create an environment where the kids could see the reason to learn mathematics and learn literacy. And one of the things I thought was, let's create a retail business, which they're going to run themselves, right? Various shops selling various things. And I went to John a few days later, said, can I see you in my office? And of course, he walked in. Body language was what? Like, you know, what am I going to get my union involved in now? Was his kind of reaction. I said, John, I couldn't help but overhear what you said in the staff room the other day about retail. I said, it's clearly something you're passionate about. He said, yeah, I was, yeah. I said, well, look, I've spoken to the local supermarket and they run retail management courses. And I said, as you know, I want to set up the kids running their own retail business in the school. I've managed to blag a free place for a week-long retail management course at the supermarket. Do you fancy it? And if you go along, my only thing I need you to commit to is coming back and leading on the development of the retail project for the kids. And he went, yeah, yeah, okay. He was a bit skeptical, but he went, yeah, yeah, I'll go. And he came back a week later, because most professional development in most organizations is usually centered around, how do I be more efficient at what I've always done? So his professional development had always been, how do I become a more effective teacher? So it was a groundbreaker. I sent him off to a completely dislong to learn about retail management for a week. And he came back changed. He came back with a whole list of ideas and plans and things he wanted to do. And a bit like the boy in the chicken and the pigeon coop, right? This guy transformed. And by the time I left the school, one of my proudest moments was he was one of the senior leadership team who was one of the greatest advocates for what we'd done.
That's great. And I used to run a membership organization. And I used to say to my colleagues, you know, when our members were moaning and complaining, I used to say that they are our greatest asset, because if they care enough to moan and complain, if we can turn things around, we can expect them to advocate for us in the same way. And very often it's the people that stay silent that you don't know about that are a bigger problem, because you can't engage with them in the same way. There are remarkable similarities between the two stories, and both go back to, I think, your original answer, when it's about not dictating you shall do this and you shall do that, but engaging people and getting to the core of their passion. And what strikes me about, can we call him Pigeon Coop Boy? Because that really works. Yeah. Well, Pigeon Coop Boy is, you've got the most undisciplined student in your school, probably demonstrating the most discipline, because he's up at 5 o'clock in the morning cleaning out the pigeon coop. He's going back there in the evening. So he has more discipline than most of the kids in that school. It's just directing it. And by tapping into that passion, but also making him feel seen, then means you can tap into that discipline. We are running out of time. We've only got a couple of minutes left. I have promised that there were three things out of your original answer I wanted to cover. So it's going to be a fairly short one on this, but I like to keep to my promises. And by the way, and people have heard me say this before, I always think it's a sign of a great interview. Apart from my opening question, I haven't asked you anything I planned to. But in that original answer, you said that before that school had 8 principals in 12 years. This is something that intrigues me as well, about the importance of consistency at leadership. You know, I support a football team who, from the time I started supporting them in 1984 through to 2007, had 3 managers, of whom one was a co-manager with another one. So 2 managers, effectively, between 1984 and 2007. Between 2007 and 2020, what year are we in? 2024, I've lost count. You know, it's like a new manager every 6 months at times, and certainly every year. And the club has gone from the Premier League down to the third division. I don't think the two things are unrelated. So what are your thoughts on, there's me saying we've got 2 minutes left and taking 2 minutes to ask the question. Don't worry, we can extend a little bit. What are your thoughts on terms of the need for consistency in leadership in order to build those relationships, build those trusts and move it forward, and the impact of all of that turnaround at leadership level?
Well, I think at the heart of it is, whatever length of your tenure, the people who you're working with have to know you care as much as they do, that you are genuinely authentic. You know, you get it. Your passion is their passion, and you're not there as a rung on a ladder. You're not there for 2 minutes. You're not there just to do a bit and move on. You know, football's a great analogy, right? Because where is the loyalty actually a lot of the time these days in professional football? Because if a manager does well at a club that's considered to be a lower level club, the club know that manager's going to get scooped up by somebody bigger. And as soon as that offer comes in, they're off. You know, I used to think the same thing even now with players. You know, when players kiss the badge, if they score a goal, you're thinking, yeah, but you know, next week when one of the bigger teams comes in, you're going, and then you'll kiss their badge. So I think that whole thing about authenticity, for however long you are with those people, you genuinely care. And again, it goes back to this thing about understanding that community, really taking time to understand them, not coming in thinking, I'm the star, it's my job to impose. It's your job, number one, is to truly understand that community and to reflect that in the way you speak, the way you act, the things you do. So for however long you're there, I think that's important. I think part of that is that you are there for the ups and the downs. You are committed. And the truth is, we all know the nature of any organization. When your leadership is really tested is not when things are going well, it's when things are going badly. And people need to know that you're in the trenches with them when that happens. And again, great leadership for me, and we could parallel this to the political level. It's fascinating right now that you see senior leaders, particularly in the UK, blaming everybody but themselves for the problems people are facing. And that's one of the other reasons there's a lack of trust, right? And I think part of that authenticity is to hold you courageous enough, honest enough, to hold yourself to account as much as you do the people you're working with. Because again, people then trust you. They believe in your authenticity, and you believe that you are genuinely in the trenches with them. So I think for me, all of those things, it's about how you behave, how you respond, how you react, how you communicate, how you build relationships. If I can, Andy, and to wrap this answer, I want to finish with the ultimate name drop, right? You know, it's almost a contractual obligation. A few years ago, and I won't explain now how it happened, I got to work with former President Barack Obama. And because of what I said earlier about my passion for American, you can imagine it was one of the all-time great men. In fact, the plasma TV on our wall has been replaced by a portrait of me and President Obama. But something he said, I think, speaks to the very heart of this. I asked him a question. I said, what do you think is the most important thing you learned during your 8-year tenure in the White House? And he flashed that smile and I melted. He said, I'll tell you. He said, when I arrived in the White House, Richard, or when I was preparing to take office on the 20th of January, he said, I realized that I was like a kid in a candy store. I could basically pick up the phone and invite the world's greatest technical experts to come and work with me. He said, the greatest economists, technical scientific thinkers, political strategists. He said, what I realize now when I reflect on the 8 years I was in the White House, and particularly, he said, the problems that crossed my desk. So what I realize is that virtually none of them, when you strip them back, are technical by nature. They were human. They were about love, anger, jealousy, greed, hatred, fear, tribalism. He said, the problem is when our backs are against the wall, we look to design our way out of that problem with a technical solution before we've truly understood the human condition. And so for me, at the heart of everything you've said about the longevity or the impact of leadership is to remember that actually at the heart of almost any situation you face today, tomorrow, or the day after, to take a step back, take a breath and say, before we try and find the technical imposition or strategy for this, do we truly understand the human condition that lies underneath it?
Well, that's an absolutely perfect note on which to end our conversation. It reflects back to what you were saying about not starting with systems and structures, but starting from a human point of connection. It's exactly the same point. What you may not be aware of is that Barack and Michelle Obama have also taken down their plasma TV and replaced it with a portrait of Barack Obama and you in conversation. And you're that inspiring. So, Richard, thank you so much for joining me on the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure, Andy. Thanks for inviting me on.
So thanks to Richard for joining me. As I said, and I do say this occasionally, I didn't go anywhere near my pre-prepared questions because there was just so much to dig into there. So much of it that was resonant with the premise of this podcast, which is fortunate, and also with a lot of the things that I talk about. I particularly like that virtuous cycle that I sort of picked up from Richard's conversation. If you're genuinely curious about people, you're going to listen to them, you're going to be more authentic in the way you engage with them, and it's going to lead to more vulnerability, which in turn makes you more curious and so forth. Definitely feel a blog coming along with that in mind. You can see a lot in the way Richard talks in how that works for him to be able to motivate demotivated students and staff members, team members. And it comes down to the same stuff. It's listening and engaging. It's making people feel seen and heard. I think that probably sums up most of what Richard said in the conversation. Making people visible, making people feel seen and heard, I think would be a good overarching summary of what we've heard today. I hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. Please do share it on social media. Join our conversation on the various social channels. And of course, leave a review and rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it. Now, I always say join us again next week for another episode of the Connected Leadership Podcast. The next 3 or 4 are going to be a bit special because the Olympics are about to start. So from next week, we've got an Olympic and Paralympic special series for you. And we start with Karin Davis, who is a 2-time Olympic gold medalist and 3-time Olympian for the United States in rowing. She's president of the U.S. Olympian and Paralympian Association and we had a fantastic chat. So join us again next week for a special Olympics edition of the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Leadership Podcast. If you found this valuable, please subscribe, tell your colleagues and friends, share on social media, and post a review on the podcast channel you use to listen to it. And of course, join us again soon for another interesting interview and great Connected Leadership tips.